Solomonster, back with you. For all the faults that we can find with 2020, even with few, if any, fans for much of the year in the stands, there were still a ton of great wrestling matches, and these are the 10 that I feel were the best. My top 10 match list for 2020, I have narrowed the list down to the 10 best, ranked in order from bottom to top. So let's not waste any time here and dive right into this. Starting with number 10, the 30-man Royal Rumble match, January 26th, from Minute Maid Park in Houston, Texas. I may be a little kinder to this because it's the only fond memory I have, really, of a WWE match with fans in the stands last year. The past 2 years of having the Rumble in a baseball stadium, I think, gives it a great vibe, and I would like to see them continue that tradition again in the future once it's safe to do so. I felt like I was on an island of one heading into the show last year. As somebody who, and I know I wasn't the only one, but there was a lot of hate. And I remember addressing it on the podcast at the time. A lot of skeptics, people who didn't like the idea of including Brock Lesnar in the Royal Rumble match itself while he was WWE champion. Not usually the way it works. Usually the champion stays out and the winner of the Rumble gets to choose either which champion they're going to face. It used to work that way many years ago. Or you meet the champion of the brand that you're currently a part of. But this was unique. This was different. A lot of people didn't seem to like it. I thought it opened up a ton of possibilities. Thought it opened up a ton of storyline possibilities. And, you know, being different doesn't always mean that it's a good thing. Just to be different for the sake of being different isn't always such a great thing. But, you know, try something different. In this case, I thought it added more appeal to the Rumble. The Royal Rumble is always my favorite event of the year. WWE rebounded from those awful Rumbles in 2014 and 2015. 2015 being, I think, one of the worst they've ever done in the history of the event. And they had an enjoyable one in 2016 where the championship was on the line for the first time since 1992. They had a really good one in 2018 that Shinsuke Nakamura won. They had a pretty good one, I thought, in 2019. Last year, the story of Brock Lesnar entering at number one and dominating the first half gave the match an energy that, you know, sometimes it lacks in the early part of the match. And it had to happen that way to set up what happened in the second half of the Rumble. His former roommate, his former training partner, right, from the University of Minnesota, Shelton Benjamin, entering at number 10. Brock's got a big smile on his face. He's all buddy-buddy with Brock. You knew where it was going, but still. Brock would show a different emotion each time somebody different would come out. When Keith Lee came out, right? Keith Lee came out at number 13. And Brock had this look on his face like, oh, here we go, here we go. We got big boy coming down to the ring. And Keith Lee wasn't in there for very long. I mean, if he was in there for 4 or 5 minutes, I'd be shocked. He went out pretty quickly, but for the time he was in there, you know, he hung. He hung with the big boys. And, you know, that's a good thing when you have somebody that the casual audience maybe is not all that familiar with. I think at the time he had just won the North American title. My timeline is right on that. So that was a cool spot. Drew McIntyre finally booting him out of the ring 36 minutes in, to the delight of the 40,000 people in the stadium. I mean, seriously, if you go back and watch that moment, the place exploded when he knocked Brock out of the ring. And I think it was a combination of people liked Drew. They were coming around to him as a big babyface, but also they were just happy that Brock went out because Brock was dominating everybody. He got the diesel spot from 94 on steroids. So when he went out, the place exploded. It made for a great moment. The return of Edge after a 9-year retirement. And Edge working together during the match with his old Rated RKO partner before eliminating Randy Orton, which then led to their feud heading into WrestleMania. I had number 26 in the Royal Rumble pool in our Facebook group. And number 26 just so happened to be Roman Reigns. So I was feeling pretty good. Until Drew McIntyre ruined it for me at the end and eliminated Reigns. But I thought it was a great final three. They had Edge, they had Drew McIntyre, and they had Roman Reigns. And really, if you look at it, even if you thought Drew's going to win, or you thought Roman's going to win, any one of those three, you could have made a plausible case for winning the Royal Rumble. They could have believably won. That doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes it's a little too obvious. If it comes down to the final three or four and you kind of know who's going to win, I think in that case, there was some doubt. You know, but Drew looked like a superstar in the end. He got, really, if you think about it, he got his WrestleMania moment at the Royal Rumble. Because little did he know that he would be winning his first WWE Championship in an empty warehouse a few months later. But I thought this was a very enjoyable Rumble match. And so I have that at number 10. Number 9, Jon Moxley versus Minoru Suzuki for the IWGP United States Championship, New Japan Pro Wrestling's New Beginning in Osaka, February 9th. I was looking forward to this match ever since Moxley arrived in New Japan, and they did not disappoint. Moxley enters through the crowd. He immediately puts his belt down. He walks all the way up the ramp. Wasn't like a long ramp. It's not a big building. I actually liked the environment. I liked the atmosphere I think it was Osaka Joe Hall, I believe. He walks up the ramp, challenges Suzuki to come on down and meet me on the ramp. And Suzuki obliges. He brings two chairs along, one of which he throws down for Moxley to use. And that's how this match begins, as a duel, only instead of lightsabers, they're using chairs. They get in the ring, they're biting each other. Back outside they go. Moxley puts Suzuki through a table, and I will never forget that great camera shot, that zoom in of Suzuki after going through the table, smiling. He's smiling like he's enjoying himself. I don't doubt that he was. I'm sure Moxley would smile too. This was right up his alley. He even grabbed a piece of the table, Suzuki did. He started bashing himself in the head with it. Moxley didn't want to feel left out, so he starts doing the same thing. I said in my review, the two of them should have had a straitjacket match. Because they belong in one. So he smashes a chair a little bit later over Suzuki's head. And again, he just stands there smiling. He gives Suzuki a double arm DDT onto the chair. Suzuki's back up, but he's on wobbly legs. Starts slapping himself to try to wake himself up or psych himself up. And then he slaps the shit out of Moxley. And Moxley hits an elevated Death Rider for the win. Exactly the kind of match that you would expect these two to have. It was so much fun to watch. In hindsight, probably should have done a title change here and gotten the belt off Moxley, given the fact that he has not been able to defend the damn thing ever since. That was his last defense. But who knew, right? Who knew? Number 8. Sami Zayn, AJ Styles, and Jeff Hardy. Triple threat ladder match for Jeff Hardy's Intercontinental Championship. WWE Clash of Champions on September 27th. Now, it's hard to do anything really unique in ladder matches anymore. I mean, we've seen it all, right? I mean, you've seen every permutation of a ladder match that you can have. Singles ladder matches, tag team ladder matches, triple threat ladder matches, TLC multi-man, six-man, eight-man ladder matches, all kinds of matches, TLC matches involving ladders and crazy ladder spots. Because what do you do when everybody else has done the craziest thing you can think of? Well, you got to out-crazy them. You try to think of different spots, innovative uses of the ladder. And these three went out there on this night to open the show, and that's what they did. They did things in this match that I had never seen done before, and it felt like they were trying to kill each other. So it didn't really feel to me, as sometimes this is the case, it didn't really feel to me like they were out there just to put a show on, let's do spots. they wanted to work unique spots into the match, but it felt like they were in a war and they were really trying to just kill each other because it was all about the championship. It was all about the Intercontinental title, which does not feel nearly as special as it did many, many years ago. But for one night, it felt like they were out there fighting for the world title. Sammy grabbed handcuffs out of his jacket. He grabbed his jacket first and pulled handcuffs out of his jacket pocket late in the match. And he placed one of the cuff rings through the hole in Jeff Hardy's earlobe. And he attached the other ring to one of the ladders. So we had the visual. We had the visual of Jeff Hardy cuffed to the ladder, not by his wrist, but by his ear, which looked painful. And as he admitted after the match, it looked painful because it was painful. And he probably regrets even doing the spot. Then Sammy cuffs himself to AJ as AJ is trying to climb in the ring, so AJ can't climb. He's got dead weight attached to him now. Jeff has to then pick up the ladder outside the ring that he is attached to and carry it into the ring with him and fling it and use it as a weapon, but he's hurting himself. This was insanity to watch. In the end, Sammy retrieves both belts because when he came back from his little COVID sabbatical, he had the unauthorized Intercontinental title that he never returned. Jeff had the new one, and Sammy retrieved them both to become the Undisputed Champion. This was probably the wildest ladder match that I have ever seen. And I've seen a lot of ladder matches, so have you guys. So that's no small compliment to these guys. It really felt like the wildest ladder match that I'd ever seen. And that includes 15 years of Money in the Bank matches and however many years of TLC matches. A tremendous open to this pay-per-view. Maybe the best WWE opener all year. Number 7, AJ Styles versus Daniel Bryan in the finals of the Intercontinental Title Tournament from the June 12th episode of SmackDown. Before that ladder match came this match, which was the end result of a tournament to crown a new champion, with Sami Zayn being out after WrestleMania. This was the same episode, by the way, of SmackDown where Sheamus forced Jeff Hardy to submit to a drug test in the middle of the ring, and then Jeff splashed urine in Sheamus' face. Over 30 minutes this match lasted, and these two went out there and they put on a clinic. The only negative to it was the fact that they took 4 commercial breaks during the match because it was so long. You know, obviously on pay-per-view, there would have been no interruptions. But even still, this was just a great professional wrestling match between two of the best in the world, even to this day. You know, yes, they're older. You know, AJ's now in his 40s, and he probably won't be full-time active for that much longer. Daniel Bryan's talking about going from full-time to part-time. Even still, two of the very best in the world at what they do. My favorite spot of the match was Bryan setting up for the running knee. And as he ran at AJ and got airborne, AJ caught him and turned it into a Styles clash. But AJ did not have enough left in him to make the cover. He did set up for the phenomenal forearm, though, and that was enough to win him his very first Intercontinental title. Great match. Number 6. One of the most talked about matches of 2020, and as of this moment, we'll see how long it lasts, but as of this moment, the swan song for The Undertaker against AJ Styles in a Boneyard match on night 1 of WrestleMania 36. This is the 3rd straight AJ Styles match I have in this countdown, in this top 10. And you'll notice all different types of matches. The match with Bryan, straight wrestling match. Like I said, just a clinic for half an hour in the ring with those two guys. Holds, it was based around holds and counters, right? And it was in front of no audience. There might have been some developmental people in the audience at that point. So you have that match. You have a ladder match with a bunch of wild spots and a lot of violence, and then you have a boneyard match, which isn't even in an arena setting, so you weren't going to have fans no matter what. It was a boneyard match outdoors, on location, in a makeshift graveyard. Three very different types of matches, all of which involving AJ Styles, all of which made my top 10 for the year. Now, going into WrestleMania last year, when it became clear that AJ Styles was the chosen opponent for The Undertaker, if you were to pinpoint any one person on the current WWE roster who at this point in time could give The Undertaker the best possible in-ring match that he could have, because he is very limited in what he can do. Look, he's older, he's beat up, he's still in very good shape, relative probably to the average person, I'm sure, but he's not The Undertaker of 5 years ago. He's not The Undertaker of 15 years ago. He needs the right dance partner if he is going to be in the ring. He was very, very unhappy with how he looked physically and how the match went with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 33. So I'm sure it was very important to him to have the right opponent, and he personally wanted AJ Styles to be that guy. AJ wanted him to be the guy. When AJ got the sense, hey, you know, maybe he's interested, he called The Undertaker. He wanted the match, and Undertaker had to think about it. But Undertaker, you know, if you watch his documentary on the network previously, you know, maybe like a year prior, 2 years prior, he was watching AJ thinking that AJ was the closest thing they had on the current roster to Shawn Michaels. And he would have been his hand-picked guy. It just didn't work out at that point. So you had kind of a mutual admiration thing going on between the two of them. I say all of that because while I agree that AJ was the best opponent for him in those circumstances, I did not have high hopes for this match. I just didn't. Judging from previous Undertaker matches, the matches in Saudi Arabia, the match with Triple H, the tag match, which was a total disaster, right? The Brothers of Destruction against DX. Whatever could go wrong did go wrong in that match. The match with Goldberg. There were a lot of instances of The Undertaker just not having great matches. And it looked like, all right, this is kind of closing in on the end here. Even with AJ, what kind of match are they going to have? Straight wrestling match, one-on-one, no fancy stipulation, which I assume it would have been a straight wrestling match. I didn't have high hopes. I didn't really have a need or a desire as a fan to see The Undertaker come out for yet another singles match at WrestleMania. Then COVID hits. COVID hits, changes everything. Now they have to improvise. What are we going to do? So they had to recalibrate. They came up with the stipulation they came up with. Everybody's asking, what the fuck is a boneyard match? I just figured they were being ultra sensitive and didn't want to say graveyard, which is stupid enough, but it's basically what it turned out to be. But the way it worked out was actually great, because what it allowed the two of them to do, it allowed the two of them to cut promos on each other that were way more realistic probably than they would have been otherwise heading into WrestleMania. AJ brought up Undertaker's wife, which there was a period of time, as you well know, where Undertaker was coming out more like a human being, and he actually brought his wife out with him. That was years ago. Ever since 2004, he's been the dead man. So this was kind of going back in time to the days of Big Evil and the American Badass. Undertaker was able to cut a promo, I'm thinking of the one in particular, the pre-taped one, with him looking dead into the camera, bandana on his head. He was cutting a promo not as The Undertaker, but as Mark Calloway. But he was able to talk like a normal human being. And when The Undertaker cuts a promo like that, he can cut a very intimidating promo. He's still great when it comes to promo work like that. He's fantastic. I thought it was great. So it added an element to the match now that we wouldn't have had were it not for the whole COVID situation. So the promo work heading into the match was, I thought, great stuff. Nice little throwback. Then, of course, the day before filming, Undertaker gets a phone call He's in the car after they're surveying the site, getting ready to film this big match the very next day. He's in the car on his way back to the performance center, and if you watch his documentary, he talks about this. Gets a phone call from his niece, telling him that her father, Undertaker's brother Tim, passed away. And so now he's got that weighing on his head. He's got to tell his mother, he's got to tell his entire family, which is an awful thing. He clearly is crushed by it. And on top of that, he's got this big match that he's got to go film, and it's in a friggin' makeshift graveyard. So he's dealing with the death of a close family member, but he's the Undertaker. So he's in this weird situation where he's got to film a graveyard match, and he's going to be around death and doom and, you know, all that kind of stuff and imagery, and it's got to be a weird thing. But the match itself, in terms of the final product and what we got, I loved it. I loved it. I thought the presentation was great. It was unique. This was at a time before they went into cinematic overload. I mean, look, there have been cinematic matches before. Matt Hardy really innovated it with all the broken mat stuff, the whole, you know, final deletion and everything in Impact Wrestling. WWE had tried that match, the Haunted House match or whatever they called it back in 2017 at Payback with Bray Wyatt, Randy Orton. You can find examples of those types of matches before. But this was really the beginning of the cinematic boom in wrestling that occurred last year because of COVID. So it was, at that time, it was very unique. It was shot really well. And it gave The Undertaker a chance to go out on a high note. It headlined the first night of WrestleMania. And there is no bigger spot in WWE, as they tell us every year. There's no bigger spot than the main event of WrestleMania. So, as far as the end of The Undertaker's career, I hope it is, especially after the big send-off at Survivor Series, for him to then come back for another match or a Saudi payday at this point would be beyond ridiculous. He got the send-off that he desperately wanted to have. He hated the WrestleMania 33 match. He was very critical of his own work. This guy got to go out on top, headlining a WrestleMania against a guy that he clearly respects, winning the match, literally riding off on his motorcycle, off into the night. Can't think of a better way for it to come to a close. Number 5 is the match that I thought was the WWE main roster match of the year for 2020. Sasha Banks against Bayley. Hell in a Cell for the SmackDown Women's Championship. The greatest women's Hell in a Cell match WWE has ever produced. There haven't been that many of them, but they've had a bunch. And this was easily the... And I love the one with Sasha and Becky Lynch. I would put that in number 2. But in my opinion, this was the best of the Hell in a Cells for the women that they have ever done. The story was built up over such a long period of time. I went from thinking that Sasha would be the one to do the turn. She would go babyface. Not necessarily betray Bayley. I didn't necessarily think it had to go down like that. Bayley, though, ended up being the one who turned on Sasha Banks. And when they shot that angle on SmackDown a few months ago, it was very well done. It was this extended beatdown angle. She ended up wrapping the chair around Sasha's neck. You know, she pilmanized the neck, basically. So she really kind of went to town on her. And they did this whole heavy angle. I thought it was great. Now, I had hoped that they could find a way to put the match off. Not do the match at all. Put the match off. Sasha takes an extended injury absence. Maybe she makes a surprise return in the Royal Rumble for the women this year. Wins it. Goes on to WrestleMania. But somehow find a way to just extend this out a little bit more, give Bayley a couple of other people to run through in the meantime, and get this match done finally at WrestleMania 37. But they chose to do it the way that they did. Sasha was back on TV, I think, within a week or two, and that wasn't really much of a surprise. But they went in there, they had this match, and they hit a home run. I still don't think it topped their NXT match in Brooklyn, which was about as close to perfect as you can get. There was no way that they could have matched the atmosphere for that match. I just watched Bayley. Actually, she was interviewed by Steve Austin on the Broken Skull Sessions. I just watched it a couple of days ago. Very good stuff. And when Austin was playing back highlights of the match in Brooklyn, Bayley could not stop talking about the crowd. She could not stop raving. She was getting goosebumps just watching it back. Could not stop raving about the crowd that night. Now, we were loud. Brooklyn was loud that night. And, you know, look, that's just something, the circumstances are what they are today, but that's just something you can't replicate, no matter how many chants and how many noises you pipe in, that element you can't replicate. But still, they went out there at Hell in a Cell, and they used the environment to their advantage. They tried to work some unique stuff in there with the chairs and the ladders and the kendo sticks. It was really the one match on that Hell in a Cell show. And I was digging the Roman Reigns, Jey Uso stuff too. But it really was the one Hell in a Cell match on the show this year that felt worthy of that stipulation. Because so often, you know, we get Hell in a Cell matches because of the date on the calendar. That's just how it is now. But this felt like a feud that was actually worthy of the cell. With the great finish of Sasha using the bank statement, the chair assisted around Bayley's neck. Bank statement to get Bayley to tap out, ending her run as the longest reigning SmackDown Women's Champion of all time. Number four. If that was the WWE main roster match of the year, then 4 days later came WWE's overall match of the year for 2020 from the October 29th episode of NXT UK. Walter, or should I say it the right way? Walter. There we go. I'm going to call him Walter because that's annoying. Walter against Ilya Dragunov for the United Kingdom Championship. One of only two NXT UK matches I watched in full last year. The other one was Pete Dunne's return, tagging with Dragunov against Walter and Alexander Wolfe, which actually aired only a couple of weeks before this match. I saw someone describe this match as a symphony of violence. And I think that is a perfect description of what this was. You could hear every note from the orchestra. It was an orchestra of two. Now, here in the States, the pandemic gave birth to the Thunderdome. Mel Gibson and Tina Turner gave birth to the Thunderdome, but that's beside the point. The WWE Thunderdome was the result of the pandemic, and you've got the screens, and you've got, you know, people, you know, virtually kind of beamed in there. We see the Thunderdome every week on TV. And we have fake crowd noise pumped in to at least give us some ambient background noise, which is better than nothing, I have to say. Even though they go overboard with it and it sounds totally fake sometimes, I would rather have some noise than no noise at all, personally. Well, they didn't have any of that for this match. The NXT UK, it's shot in a TV studio. And there is no Thunderdome. There are no screens, there are no fans, there are no virtual fans. They don't pipe in chants and crowd noise and all kinds of crap. It was two men and a referee. Empty arena style. So you could hear every grunt, every scream, every bit of trash talk, if Walter was saying something in a different language, maybe I didn't understand what it was, but you could see them and hear them trash talking each other. Every strike, every chop, my God, the chops from both guys, especially Walter, but both guys. This was Walter, the dominant champion, now almost 650 days and counting as of today. At the time, I think it was about 570 days or so, against the smaller underdog in Ilya Dragunov. First time I saw Dragunov in the ring was that match against Cesaro. I think it was one of the early NXT UK TakeOver shows. Maybe the first one. It was a while back. how could you not be impressed, even then? And he's better now than he was then, but how could you not be impressed? But he was coming into this match giving up almost 100 pounds to Walter. And no matter what Walter did to this kid, no matter how badly he brutalized him, he just kept coming back for more. He kept kicking out. He kept popping up. Walter threw everything at this guy. He would not stay down. There were no high spots. There were no dives, at least not that I recall. Just David meeting Goliath. And this time Goliath won. David put up a hell of a fight. He took Goliath to his absolute limit, but he's Goliath for a reason. But I said at the time, you know, British strong style. People talk about Japanese strong style. This was British strong style on display, even though neither of these men are actually British. One's a Russian, the other is an Austrian. But there has never been, I believe this. I said earlier about the ladder match of Clash of Champions, the wildest ladder match I've ever seen. I would say that this match here between Walter and Dragunov was the hardest hitting. I mean, use whatever word you want to use. Stiffest, hardest hitting match in WWE history. Easily. Now we get into the top three. Now we're getting good. Number three on my top 10 list of matches for 2020 is Kenny Omega and Hangman Adam Page against the Young Bucks for the AEW Tag Team Championship at Revolution on February 29th. This was the best tag team match of 2020 and the AEW Match of the Year. It had everything. It had action, it had storytelling. Four friends that were butting heads at the time. The Bucks were frustrated over the fact that they had yet to hold the tag team titles, even though they went around calling themselves the best tag team in the world. And yet here are their two friends, Kenny Omega and Hangman Page. They're not even a real team. They're a makeshift team. They beat them to the punch. They won the tag team titles before the Bucks did. Meanwhile, you got Hangman Page, who's developed a drinking problem that coincidentally has gotten him more over with the audience. It turned this guy into a superstar. But, you know, really that drinking problem got started because he was, in storyline, he was feeling ostracized from the rest of the elite. He was feeling left out. He felt like an outsider among the other members of the group. And he was sort of drifting off on his own, doing his own thing, acting very weird. And he would piss off the Bucks by gloating about the fact that they won the titles before the Bucks did. So this caused a lot of friction between the two teams. But the other part of this story, was the tension that had been building for weeks and weeks and weeks between Kenny Omega and Hangman Page. And a Hangman Page heel turn or Revolution seemed pretty likely. But the thing is, the guy was getting over like crazy in front of those crowds. He was becoming one of the hottest parts of the whole show. In a way that I'm going to assume they weren't necessarily expecting. So it would have been very foolish. I'm not saying that the original plan was to turn him heel. I don't know if there was an original plan and they changed. But Hangman Page was getting over. And once that started happening, it would have been really dumb to turn him heel at that point. The fans were actually booing the Bucks late in this match. Because of the way they were acting, they were starting to act more heelish. You know, they were kind of holding back until Hangman hocked a loogie right in Matt Jackson's face. And at that point, that set off Matt Jackson. And from that point on, the Bucks were acting more heelish. Buckshot lariats to both Matt and Nick finished them off. And Hangman and Omega, they would go on to reign for several more months before dropping the belts. But this was 30 minutes of just tag team excellence. And I know there's a lot of people out there who, if they don't like AEW, then they just don't like AEW. But there are also people who watch AEW television, but they may not like Omega, they may not like the Bucks. I never really hear from people that don't like Hangman. I'm sure there are people out there. He doesn't seem to bother people the way that the Bucks do, and Cody and Kenny, they have a lot of... they get a lot of flack from a lot of people for whatever reason. I mean, you can be a fan of whoever the hell you want to be a fan of. Maybe with the Bucks, they don't like, you know, the indie style and all the super kicks and the flips and the big flashy moves and the dives and everything and whatever, that's fair. But I think even those people, if they sat down and watched this match, would, and they knew the story going in, I would think they would at least appreciate the storytelling heading into this match. It just, it all came together perfectly. And AEW had plenty of great matches last year, but in my opinion, this one was the best one of them all. Now, last year was the first year that New Japan Pro Wrestling hosted a two-night Wrestle Kingdom. And because the show happens right at the beginning of the year, every January 4th, regardless of the day of week, every January 4th is the big Tokyo Dome show, which really has only been called Wrestle Kingdom, I think, since 2007. But because it happens at the very beginning of the year, right after New Year's, it would be very easy for a lot of the matches on these shows to just get lost in the shuffle. Kind of the way that certain movies get shafted, I think, during Oscar season. If they hit theaters a little too early, people aren't really talking about them anymore. But then you've got certain matches that are just too good to be forgotten. The main event of Wrestle Kingdom 14, Night 2, is hailed as an all-time classic, and deservedly so. That's why I have it at number 2 on my list. It was the finale of the Double Gold Dash, champion against champion, title for title, with the IWGP champion Kazuchika Okada meeting IWGP Intercontinental champion Tetsuya Naito January 5th at the Tokyo Dome. Okada retained his title over Kota Ibushi on night 1. Naito beat Jay White to reserve his spot in the main event on night 2, and so all roads led to Okada and Naito. Got to get context here, though. You got to give a little bit of the history to understand what made this such a big deal. At Wrestle Kingdom 8 in 2014, Okada beat Naito to retain his IWGP title. It was a night where their match, which otherwise would have been the main event, I mean, it was for the IWGP heavyweight title, but on this particular night, due to a fan vote, their match was expelled out of the main event in favor of the Intercontinental title match involving Shinsuke Nakamura. And one of the main reasons for that is because Naito just was not really all that popular at that time. Not as popular as he would become later on. And he harbored a lot of resentment for that for many years. That was kind of part of the whole storyline. Anyway, 4 years later, 2018, Wrestle Kingdom 12. Okada pins Naito again to retain his title. And so here, this was Naito's chance at redemption after a 7-year story arc dating all the way back to 2013 and the build-up to that first match at the Tokyo Dome. He had fallen twice before to Okada. Would the third time be the charm? Would this finally be his big moment? In their last match, Naito, who used to be called the Stardust Genius, briefly reverted back to the old version of Naito, the clean babyface version of Naito, clean cut babyface, going for his big move, the Stardust Press, off the top rope. That's the move that he abandoned when he basically stopped caring about the fans. And when he came back from excursion, he had adopted the Destino as his new finisher. Well, this was a big deal, the fact that in this match, their last match here, he was going for the move again. The fans knew it. They knew the setup for the Stardust Press. We're seeing the old Naito, and up he goes to the top. He goes for the move again, and it backfires on him. Okada gets the knees up. He ends up going on a few minutes later to win the match. That was their second meeting. And so that match ends, And just to rub salt in the wound, Okada, when the match is over, he gets on the mic. Naito is leaving ringside. And Okada asks him if he enjoyed his main event at the Tokyo Dome. Fast forward to their match last year. Naito sets Okada down near the corner late in the match. And he's going up. He's going up for that same Stardust press, and the crowd can't believe that he would even attempt to try this move again. Because every time he has used it against Okada before, he has failed. But this time, he nails it. First time that he successfully hit that move in 5 years. He hits the Stardust press, only gets a near fall. After all that. Now, that's what you call a troll job, is what you call that. That's a false finish troll job. But a great one. Okada kicks out. But Naito does end up getting the win with the Destino. He finally pins Okada, and he becomes the first ever IWGP double champion with the world, or the heavyweight, I should say, and the Intercontinental titles. And then the cherry on top was after the match, Naito is responding to Okada's words from a couple of years earlier. And he goes, "Okada, winning the Tokyo Dome main event. It's awesome, isn't it? Because someday in the main event of the Tokyo Dome, let's fight again." And then, of course, if you remember, they sent Kenta out there to ruin his big moment and beat the crap out of him. But what an ending. What an ending. What a match, and what an ending to the story. Story-wise, it was the best match all year. And if you were a fan of both main events, both of the Wrestle Kingdom main events last year, you may have placed this one over the first one for that very reason. But I can't bring myself to do it. I have to go with what I thought was the better match of the two. Which is why my number one pick for the best pro wrestling match of 2020 goes to Kazuchika Okada against Kota Ibushi. G1 Climax winner, Kota Ibushi, in the main event of Wrestle Kingdom 14, Night 1, on January 4th for the IWGP Heavyweight title. An outstanding main event. 25 minutes in, Okada is smacking Ibushi around, and the emotion just completely drains out of Ibushi's face. He goes into this trance-like state, call it murder mode, and things get scary. He starts raining down closed fists on Okada. You could hear them echo. You could hear all these strikes echoing throughout the dome. And they had 40,000 people in the building, so it's not as if it was an empty arena or anything like that. You had a lot of people there that night, certainly more than you had this year. And you could hear every shot just reverberate. Okada is just trying to cover up, trying to shield himself and protect himself before he gets killed. And that's what he wanted. Okada wanted to see how Ibushi would react. Well, he got his answer. Ibushi misses a Phoenix Splash. Two Rainmakers from Okada, and I thought the match was over, but alas, Ibushi kicks out. Two more Rainmakers with a third one on the way, but Ibushi, in his most desperate moment of all moves, goes for the V-trigger. His old friend, Kenny Omega's move, and then he tries for the Kamigoye, the big knee to put this guy down once and for all, but Okada blocks it, hits a sit-down, or a sit-out, tombstone pile driver. And one final Rainmaker that just folds Ibushi up. Folded this guy up like a salami sandwich in my old lunchbox. And that's all she wrote. When the match was over, I really, if there was one disappointment that I had, I really was kind of hoping that Ibushi would win. And then he would go on to night two. It felt like the right time. Were it not for the story arc with Naito, which I get why they did what they did. You know, they completed it the next night. That made for a great moment. So I get why they did it. But man, I was hoping for an Ibushi win. I had to wait 12 more months to get it, but we did finally get it this year. I almost hate ranking one over the other. I wish I could have had a tie for first place between these two matches. This one and the Naito one, but that would be a cop-out. So purely as a match, I think this is better. And for me, it didn't get any better than those two matches all year long. That's back-to-back 30-minute match-of-the-year main events for Okada. And there is no argument anymore. I don't know that there ever was an argument, but certainly not now. There is no argument for whether or not he is among the greatest of all time. The answer is yes. You can debate whether or not he is the best, and if you're not a New Japan fan, then obviously you're going to laugh at that. But that's fine. You want to have a debate over whether or not he is the best, or one day when he's done, he may go down as the best. You can debate that until you turn blue in the face, but you cannot debate the fact that this man is absolutely on the list of one of the all-time greats. And look, he still may go on to be the best. He's only 33 years old. Feels like he's been around forever, but he's only 33. He could wind up like Minoru Suzuki in his 50s, having great matches. They would be very different, but they would still be great. But at 33, when you look at the body of work that he has put together already in his career, he is one of the very best ever. So that's your list. Those are my 10 best matches of 2020. The ones that you all should go out of your way to see or see again, if you've already seen them. There's too many honorable mentions to name all of them. I know I'm going to leave some out here. But I want to show some love for some of these matches. I loved the 30-minute Iron Man match on Dynamite. The February 26th episode of Dynamite between Kenny Omega and Pac. The fastest 30-minute match you'll ever see. I mean, that match just breezed by. Didn't feel like 30 minutes. All action. Just a ton of energy. I love that match. I enjoyed Edge and Randy Orton at Backlash more than I did their WrestleMania match. The greatest wrestling match ever. Wasn't even the top 10 greatest match of the year. But I do think it deserves some recognition here. I loved the Drew McIntyre-Roman Reigns match at Survivor Series, and I hope we get a chance to see it again at some point this year. Could have easily headlined a WrestleMania with a match like that, minus the cheap finish, which took it down a notch. And I had a few people, including Matt, so if he's listening, shout out to Matt. I had a few people tell me that, you know, Salamas, you gotta watch the GHC title match from Pro Wrestling Noah from last month. I think it was December 6th between Go Shiozaki and Takashi Sugira. That it was a late contender for match of the year. You got to give it a watch. It's on YouTube and go watch it. Now look, I don't watch Noah. I know who Go Shiozaki is. I know he was the GHC champion all year. I'd, you know, see his name. I'd read about him in the Observer as far as what he was up to. I did watch the match. It is a 51-minute match, which is, I gotta say, it is impressive at 50 years old for Sugira to be in a match that long. I think he's 51. Sugira, I know, of all things, I know him from the Ring of Honor show that I went to back in 2006. It was one of the earliest Ring of Honor shows I had ever gone to. Maybe it was only the second or third. It was Glory by Honor 5, Night 2, which I think is actually, people I think are in agreement, one of the better ROH shows that the company's ever done. And Bruno Sammartino made a special appearance in front of the crowd that night. The whole roster was around the ring like lumberjacks, you know, soaking up his every word. He cut a promo. A lot of memorable things that night. But there was a GHC title defense on that show. I remember because it was one half of this big double main event that they had promoted. The other main event was Bryan Danielson, you might know him, defending the ROH title against Kenta. But the GHC title match had Naomichi Marufuji, who I think had only won the title maybe, I don't know, like a week or two before that show. So he was the new champion. He had Marufuji defending the title against Nigel McGuinness. And Sugiro was one of the men who came out in Marufuji's corner that night. So, of all things, where do I know him from, or what was the first, you know, appearance that he made that I saw him? That's when it wasn't on a Noah show, it was at a Ring of Honor show I just so happened to be at 15 years ago. It was hard for me, though, I gotta tell you, to really get into the match, because I knew nothing about the story going in. I only loosely knew who they were, and I knew nothing about the story. I'm sure there was a story to it. You know, maybe it was Sugiro going in there at 50 years old and trying to prove that he can still do it. I mean, I'm just making that up now. I don't know. I didn't know going in what the story was. And the action was good. I mean, the closest thing that I would compare this match to from this list would be the Walter Dragunov match from NXT UK, which was not 51 minutes, but just a hard-hitting affair. Hard-hitting, trying to tell a story through, you know, all of the violence and all of the moves and nothing crazy, no big high spots. You know, you'll have those suplexes and whatnot where guys get dropped on the back of their neck. There was plenty of that, plenty of chops. So they were you know, telling a story. Shiozaki had his shoulder all taped up and he was selling a shoulder injury. So I picked up on all that, but you know, 51 minutes, it's a long match. And if you're not really personally attached to the performers in the ring or familiar with the story going into it and the background and the history, it's hard to get into. Unless it's just nonstop action, like if you have a really fast-paced match, 15, 20 minutes, you know, that probably would have been different. But this was a long match, and I did get bored through parts of it. Not the whole thing, but just certain parts in the middle. So I did watch it. I do think that it is worthy of an honorable mention, but couldn't rank it in my top 10. So anyway, chime in. Let me know what you guys think. If you agree with the list, or if you agree with it, but you would order it in a different way, what does your list look like? Chime in and let me know. Thank you for all the support. We just passed 61,000 subscribers earlier today on the YouTube channel, so thank you for that. If you're not subbed, what are you waiting for? Make sure you turn on notifications, and let's march on to 62,000. I'll see you soon. Take care, guys.